I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. An estimated 1% to 3% of Cape Cod's population suffers from hoarding, a mental illness that was recently given its own entry in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Hoarding is an OCD spectrum disorder, OCD being obsessive-compulsive disorder. The Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force was created in 2010 to coordinate resources across public safety, mental health, healthcare, senior services, animal welfare, and other community organizations to address the cross-discipline needs of hoarding. Joining us in our Woods Hole studio this morning, two members of the steering committee of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. Denise Egan-Stack is a licensed mental health counselor and president of the board of directors for the International Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning.
Erica Woods, a registered sanitarian and assistant health agent for the town of Orleans. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning.
All right, so let's start, Denise, with how is hoarding defined? I think people have a lot of misconceptions about hoarding.
Mm-hmm. They do. Hoarding is a complex mental health disorder that consists of three connected problems. The first is that people accumulate or acquire too many things. The second is that those people then have difficulty discarding or getting rid of possessions. And the third is that these people also experience difficulties with disorganization. And as a result, there becomes an excess of clutter. There's just too much stuff. And this excess clutter actually causes significant safety and health risks for people. Mm-hmm. It will severely impact people's ability to use their living spaces as intended. Mm-hmm. So people aren't sleeping in their own beds or cooking on their
because
stove.
Because there's stuff packed up.
Exactly. They're not bathing in their shower. And this excess clutter causes distress in people's lives, and it impacts their ability to function on a day-to-day basis.
So we mentioned hoarding is an OCD spectrum disorder. How are they related?
Well, for years, people believed that hoarding was a symptom of obsessive compulsive disorder, although those of us that specialized in treating hoarding disorders, you know, sort of knew anecdotally that this wasn't the case. It wasn't until we were able to collect a large amount of clinical, genetic, and neurobiological research that we could say for sure mm-hmm. it was something separate. And we're able to do that now in the DSM-5, which mm-hmm. you mentioned in the intro. So they're related. I would like to talk more about how they're different.
Yeah.
They're different in pretty significant ways. So the first is that hoarding thoughts are not really considered as intrusive. They're not as experienced as intrusive as thoughts are for people with OCD. OCD thoughts tend to be repetitive, distressing, unwanted. The second way in which they're important is that people with hoarding tend to not really think it's a problem. Mm-hmm. Their behaviors aren't a problem. They're not quite sure what we're all worried about. Mm-hmm. Whereas people with obsessive compulsive disorder do not want this. They know it's a problem. It's inconsistent with the way they want to live, and they work pretty hard to get rid of it. Mm. The third way in which hoarding is different from OCD is that there really isn't very much ritualistic behavior. And people, when they're collecting, they tend to get euphoric, whereas people with OCD, when they're engaging in their behaviors, they tend to be pretty distressed. Mm. And finally, when people are working towards reducing the amount of their possessions, they tend to be distressed in an angry or grief-stricken way, whereas people with OCD tend to be very anxious when they're working on reducing their symptoms.
Now, it's interesting. This disease usually begins manifesting at about age 13, mm-hmm. but generally doesn't become evident until later in life. So the average age at which hoarders enter treatment is 50.
That's right. So it's people don't really know this, but hoarding behavior tends to occur in childhood. We've seen it as early as age 3, but in general, it starts around age 13. At that point, it's not really considered a disorder. Mm-hmm. It's pretty mild. But from that point on, it takes a pretty chronic and progressive course throughout the lifespan, which basically means that it's getting worse decade by decade. So in someone's 20s or 30s, they're developing a pretty moderate problem. And then by their 40s or 50s, it's a pretty severe problem. And that's why when people seek treatment, if they're seeking treatment, it's at about age 50.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening at 13, age 13? What are we seeing? You say this starts out pretty mild. What are we mm-hmm. seeing?
We're seeing kids who form a strong emotional attachment to their objects, or maybe even place human characteristics on inanimate objects. They're not really wanting to save things. So their room might get more and more cluttered. You know, they might be rearranging things to make space. buying more bins to add, you know, mm-hmm. to their collection. They just don't want, they're accumulating things. They just don't want to be getting rid of things. Mm-hmm. It's not really causing major distress, but you're starting to see that saving and acquiring behavior occur.
I'm just thinking of teenagers' rooms. I mean, they've got things strewn everywhere, mm-hmm. and that's pretty common among mm-hmm. teenagers. So, but this is more than just a messy room. This is, they really have this attachment to the objects.
Exactly.
Right?
So, for example, I'm working with a senior in high school right now, and any attempt to get her to kind of go through her clothes. I mean, she'll keep clothes from when she was in elementary school. Mm-hmm. Clearly, they're not fitting her. They're mm-hmm. out of style. I mean, right. you know, and she doesn't want to donate them. She doesn't want to pass them down. And she does not want to discard them. Mm-hmm. She feels like this represents who she is or represents a part of her life, and she doesn't want to part with them. It's just too distressing.
Mm-hmm. So what are the things that people hoard? What are the common things that we see?
People hoard lots of things. All Most commonly, things. They're hoarding information. Mm-hmm. So newspapers, books, magazines, pamphlets. People often will also hoard clothing. Mm-hmm. It just depends on their reason for, there's specific reasons for acquiring and specific reasons for saving. Sometimes people are hoarding food, mm-hmm. but that's pretty rare.
So what are the reasons? Why would somebody, okay, I'm like a paper hoarder, for example, mm-hmm. who has, you know, newspapers. And we these are piled. And we're talking to the ceiling, right? Mm-hmm. The paths mm-hmm. through the house.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the reason why somebody hoards?
Well, people have difficulty discarding, or they save for three main reasons. People will save because their possessions have sentimental value. So as I mentioned before, this is a part of me, or this represents my life. People will also save because their possessions have instrumental value. So I need this. I need to learn this. I need to know this. I need to remember this, or I have a use for this. Or people might save because things have intrinsic value. This is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so many times people will save clothing if it feels beautiful to them, or different objects that they just think are beautiful and want in their life.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned the signs of compulsive hoarding in teenagers. But as people get older, what would be some of the signs that you would be looking for? Let's say a family member is hoarding. How would you know this?
Well, if you walked into their house, it would probably be pretty evident.
Yep.
But many times, family members will work to keep people out of their house because they know that other people might think that there's a problem. They don't want to get in trouble. They don't want people interfering. Mm-hmm. So they might avoid having people over. They might meet you out at the front porch instead of having people in. Sometimes, you know, people become much more isolated. Their activities of daily living or their hygiene might be suffering. They may be in financial distress mm-hmm. because they've overpurchased, or they're spending money on storage containers, outside storage containers or storage space.
Mm. All right. So there are different types of hoarding. We're talking about possessions here, but mm-hmm. there's also animal hoarding.
There's animal hoarding, which is fairly rare. And it's defined by the presence of a large number of animals in a home and the four following characteristics. So the first is the failure to take care of the animals. So they don't have adequate space or vet care or nutrition. The second is the person's inability to recognize how that really impacts mm-hmm. the animals, how they're suffering. The third is their obsessive attempt to collect or get more animals or maintain the number of animals that they have. And then the fourth is sort of a minimization or a denial of the problems in the living conditions for the people and the animals.
Yeah. We mentioned 1-3% of Cape Cod's population suffers from hoarding. 15 million Americans, some studies have shown that as many as 15 million Americans are compulsive hoarders. Why do you think it has taken so long to be recognized as a disease mm-hmm. of its own, and you know, its own mm-hmm. category?
Well, I think those numbers are probably low.
I think you're probably right
about
that.
Yeah, to be perfectly honest with you. But I think that people, as I mentioned earlier, people always thought it was OCD. They mm-hmm. just kind of lumped it all in. But we just needed time to accumulate the research. You know, mm-hmm. again, the clinical research, the people with hoarding disorder do not respond as well to traditional OCD treatment. We needed to accumulate that research. We needed to look at the genetics of both disorders to see how they were different. And then again, the neurobiology, mm-hmm. what was going on in the brain, how it was different from OCD.
So there's a genetic link here then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There tends to be first-degree family relatives that have disorder, hoarding disorder also.
Mm-hmm. You both said you thought the numbers were low. What do you think the numbers are?
I'm not sure what the numbers are, but I feel like it's fairly low. And most people that specialize in this disorder, hoarding disorder, feel that it's low. Yeah. I think that there isn't great community awareness, public education about it, which is part of what we're trying to do with the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force, is to change that. And, you know, people tend to be pretty isolated. Mm-hmm. Things happen in the home. They're not letting people in the home. People are finding out by mistake. And so I think that we don't have the numbers yet.
Right.
And I think with the absence of there being an actual answer on how to respond to it, people are just pushing it aside and saying, you know, we'll figure it out, or, you know, we'll work along with it.
We'll deal with it later.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I imagine a lot of times where this comes to people's attention is the health department of a town, or perhaps, you know, an EMT or something that shows up at a home. And so what happens? You get the call and what do you do?
Well, the first thing to understand is that the health department can't just go in there. We actually have to be invited in by the tenant or the occupant. So usually what will happen at that point is we'll try to reach out to the individual and see what's going on before we do anything. Ideally, the response isn't from us. Mm-hmm. Ideally, the response is from a mental health worker, caseworker, something like that. Because if we go in there, we have to identify the violations of the housing code and we issue an order. And that's it. We write them an order and say, fix it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the absence of them having the ability to make the decisions themselves and take care of themselves to a certain extent, really it kind of dies right there. And then we have to figure out where to go.
Hmm. So we tend to see comorbidity here, right? So what are the most common conditions we see along with hoarding?
So up to, and sometimes more than 50% of people with hoarding disorder are experiencing another major psychiatric disorder. So 50.4% of people are experiencing major depression. 24% are experiencing generalized anxiety disorder, 23% social phobia. So it's not just the hoarding disorder that we're contending with. And sometimes these comorbidities make it harder for people to access treatment or engage in treatment.
Mm. Well, plus, I mean, access to mental health care in itself, no matter what it is tough for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so with hoarders, many of them, as you're saying, don't think there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not apt to, on their own, mm-hmm. go and say, hey, I need help, because they mm-hmm. don't see a problem here, right?
Mm-hmm. Many people don't. And so we'll sometimes, when a problem comes to the community's attention, we'll have to use some of that as leverage to help people move into treatment. Also, specialized CBT treatment for hoarding disorder does work on enhancing motivation to help people really understand the consequences of this behavior and how many times it's also preventing them from living the life that they want to have.
Mm-hmm.
They can't have people over to their house. They feel lonely and isolated. They'd like that to change, but they can't have people over. They have grandchildren that they can't spend time with. So in treatment, you try to enhance motivation by helping people understand how tackling this problem will help them live, you know, sort of mm-hmm. a life that they want to live.
Yeah. We're talking about hoarding. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing hoarding with Denise Egan-Stack, a licensed mental health counselor, president of the board of directors for the International Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation, Erica Woods, a registered sanitarian and assistant health agent for the town of Orleans. Both are on the steering committee of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So I'm guessing that there are hoarders whose family members have no idea. You know, there may be people who are living on the Cape that are hoarders and their children live somewhere else. I was reading an interesting article in Huffington Post by Anne Brenoff, who was describing a 50-year-old California woman who was stunned to find that her 83-year-old father was a paper hoarder. You know, he was a very professional, very intelligent, IQ, you know, and the only reason she found out was because she had gone to his house. He was in the hospital. She had to get some things. And she opened the door and was like, oh my, and felt really badly that he had been living like this for obviously some time and they didn't know about it. And it was interesting. You'd think, well, how could you not know? And she said that he would meet them outside, as you were saying earlier. And they always thought that, well, he's just so anxious to see the grandchildren. He's meeting us outside. Mm-hmm. But there were probably some signs, you think, along the way that...
I think there probably were signs, especially because, you know, it's something that occurs in childhood and gets worse as time goes on. I think she was probably stunned at the amount that he had. Mm-hmm. Maybe she hadn't seen him in some time and it really can accumulate. And this is a problem that's getting worse over time and hitting its critical mass when people are, their physical capacities are reducing. They may be having more medical problems. They're more socially isolated. So things can accumulate faster.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned, we have this neighbor who calls the health department or an emergency responder who's called to the house, or it could be, you know, a family member contacting senior services. So thus the need for collaboration. So let's talk about how the task force came together.
Well, again, it came together back in 2010, and it was formed originally as the Mid-Cape Hoarding Task Force. And it is. It's health agents, fire departments, police, senior move specialists, group adult foster care, elder services, and we're all looking for an answer for it because, again, you know, we can go in and issue the order.
You can't
do it alone. So, you know, at this point in time, we're trying to coordinate our efforts and get towns to work together and start talking between the health department and fire department. In Orleans, we've been doing that. We have the fire department's Council on Aging, building, water department, everybody at the table, just so that if we come across these situations, we can see, okay, well, what can we do? You know, maybe, you know, the water department, you have kind of a relationship with this person. You can reach out to them, give them some information. You know, maybe there's a family member that we can get involved. And we have involved family members in different responses, and it's worked out quite well. Mm-hmm. You know, because again, like you said, oftentimes a family member isn't aware of it. And when it's brought to their attention, they are concerned and they are willing to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about the health and safety issues.
You know, again, basically what we're enforcing is the housing code, and we're looking for your basics, you know, proper water, heat, sewage, you know, making sure that there's, you know, adequate electrical supply, et cetera. And oftentimes, or, you know, what we've run into a few times is the fact that these people don't have running water, they don't have proper sewage, because they don't want to get out of the house anymore. They don't want to deal with these things, and they don't have the ability to make the decisions to take care of paying those bills. So oftentimes they don't have that. You know, hopefully it doesn't get to a point where we have to actually condemn the property, because that doesn't really do anybody any good, because that displaces the mm-hmm. individual. But, you know, hopefully we catch it early on enough. And as Denise said, you know, what we can do is hopefully work with some people like Denise and other organizations that can get in there, and we have the stick and say, okay, you have to do this because you're under order now. Mm-hmm. And where
good
they
cop, bad cop.
Exactly. Good yeah. cop, bad cop. And yeah. they can go in there and say, you know what, I really want to help you get them off your back and then work forward mm-hmm. from there.
So there are code violations. There's, you know, fire hazards, mm-hmm. trip hazards. There tends to be like narrow pathways. There isn't an exit route for people. So there's lots of different ways in which, you know, they're endangering themselves. The amount of clutter that they have is endangering themselves. And one of the first things that we try to do is say, this doesn't necessarily have to be a clean out. We can utilize what we call harm reduction strategies, where let's move the paper off the stovetop. Mm-hmm. You know, let's mm-hmm. create wide enough passageways so that you or first responders can get through them. And sometimes, you know, that'll help take the pressure off.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting. I was reading an article about a fire that happened in a Toronto public housing complex. And it had something, you know, it started on a balcony where there was all this stuff. And it was just, again, there was so much paper in there that mm-hmm. it turned out to be, you know, a disaster. And the fire responders were saying that wasn't the only apartment in this complex mm-hmm. that was such a fire hazard. Mm-hmm. And you can see the dilemma that especially the firefighters have, as in, you know, there's all this stuff. Can they get in there and rescue whoever's in there
Absolutely.
And not put, you know,
their own lives.
It's a major concern, and I know that that's a big question out there as well. You know, what do the fire departments do? Because they don't want to put their firefighters into harm's way, but at the same time, that's a firefighter's job, and that's what he wants to do, is go in and save that individual. And so it is. Yeah.
But there are times when properties are put on a list of, you know, do not go in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is too dangerous to go in if there is a problem.
Yeah, I was reading another article that was, I can't remember which town, maybe it was Bourne, where a firefighter had gone down into the basement. I don't remember. And this person was collecting like auto parts or something. Mm-hmm. And these boxes fell on him and he was basically trapped down there. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, somebody had to come down and get him out. So it's very
dangerous.
That's
the other thing, too, is, you know, as far as the fire regulations, and I'm certainly not an expert on it, but, you know, everybody talks about the stacks of paper and the fact that, obviously it's flammable and that's fuel for a fire. But apparently that cannot be ordered as a fire concern because it's not an immediate fire concern. If you have a frayed electrical cord going under that stack, it is. They unplug it. It's no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force is really working on resolving properties that come to the public's attention, right? And so, like Erica said, not one person or department can handle that or resolve that on its own. So it really is a team approach. And that's part of our mission, is to promote this idea of joint service plans and come up with a model for how to implement that, how we work together. Because up until this point, you know, it's like a hot potato. Well, health department's done what they can. Mental health, it's your issue. And mental health passes it on to the next. So really what we're doing now is trying to develop a model by which we're all working together, sticking with it.
Well, that kind of leads to my next question. You've developed protocol for handling hoarding cases. So what is that protocol?
Basically, it's kind of what we were discussing, you know, the good cop, bad cop. You know, obviously, you have to make your initial assessment and find out what's going on. And then we, you know, kind of get together and put together a plan and figure out how to move forward on this. They've been very successful up in Boston at Mass Housing. They have a sanitation and hoarding and sanitation initiative that's been put together. And that's what we, you know, we're working on.
Replicating that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And basically, again, it's like we were discussing as far as, okay, is it at a point where we need to issue an order, or is it a point where we can get somebody else in there and say, you know what, the health department is going to come in. And if they do, this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So when a case comes to us, one of the first things we try to do is figure out what are the resources available to this person? You know, how can the health department be a resource? How can elder services be a resource? What resources do they have based on the type of insurance that they have? What mental health resources are available? And then we'll work together as a team and figure out who's going to do what. What are the priorities? Generally, we're working towards harm reduction. So let's get in there and figure out what we need to do to sort of resolve some of these violations. And then who's going to work with the family and what leverage does the family have? And how can we provide specialized cognitive behavioral therapy for this person with hoarding disorder? Mm-hmm. So, and then we have every other month meetings where we can come together as a group and do some case consultation, not within the team, but also with other members of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force, sort of weighing in with different ideas that they might have. Mm-hmm. Many times cases are resolved successfully. Mm-hmm. Other times they're not. But we really do put in a lot of time and energy and effort to try to help people stay in their homes in a safe way.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how is it treated?
So there is a specialized CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy for hoarding disorder, which I mentioned before. And the components of that are assessment. So there are standardized measures that we use to determine the severity of the hoarding, because we want to reflect back to that as the person progresses through treatment to see if we're actually making a difference. I also mentioned motivational enhancement. So we're working with people to increase their insight level, increase motivation level, and help them manage or resolve some ambivalence to change. We are helping them set some goals for themselves. Those might be harm reduction strategies or having people over, or being able to eat at their kitchen table. We also need to teach people skills. As I mentioned before, people have a hard time processing information. So we're teaching them organizing skills, decision-making skills, emotion management skills. We challenge their beliefs about their possessions, that they can't live without them, that if they discard this, they'll never, ever forget it, and it'll be with them forever. They'll be at a high level of distress forever. And then we actually provide assistance, practical support as they sort and discard, make decisions about their possessions. Mm. That can happen in individual treatment. All of what I just said can happen in individual treatment or in group treatment.
So you said mentioned the severity. Mm-hmm. So are there levels of this? I mean, you know, we have mm-hmm. these visions in our head of, you know, the pathways through and, you know, the stove
yes.
or the oven is full of paper or whatever it is that
yes.
they're hoarding. So,
yep.
so you could have a mild case of this then?
You could. Hmm? You could. There's something called the Clutter Image Rating Scale. Hmm. And there's actual pictures, 9 pictures for a bedroom or a kitchen. And it ranges, you know, from 1 to 9 on a level, and that'll give you a picture of how much of that particular room is hoarded or how much clutter there is. And then you correspond that amount with what you see in the pictures, and that becomes a rating.
So if somebody is as more of a milder case,
mm-hmm.
will that progress? You mentioned that this happened
It may,
but it may not.
It may or it may not. Oftentimes people experience a loss or a trauma, which will exacerbate their current level of symptoms. So sometimes people will describe their hoarding symptoms as sort of getting worse progressively over time. Other people will say it happens in fits and starts. Mm-hmm. You know, if life is really hard or something bad happens, it gets worse. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's progressing. It's a chronic and progressive course across the lifespan.
So I'm sure some people say, well, let's just clean up the house and we'll move on. But that doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You know, first of all, it tends to come back again. You know, they have a very strong reaction to it. And there have been cases where a person has committed suicide after a clean out because it's just too traumatic for them.
If you think about people with compulsive hoarding disorder, they form very, very strong attachments to their possessions. And like I said before, they're sometimes attributing human characteristics to their things. So if I bring this doormat to the dump, it'll feel abandoned. It'll feel lonely. They also have very, very strong beliefs about not wasting things or lost opportunities if they don't have their things or appreciating the beauty in things. And so if you think about what a clean out does, it's taking all of that away from people. And so like Erica said, it is oftentimes experienced as a trauma.
Right.
And people will fill their house back up within a matter of months. Mm. It's not effective and will oftentimes turn them off from treatment or the supports that they were using. Mm. They'll become much more distrusting. And sometimes there was a case in Martha's Vineyard, actually, where someone committed suicide after a clean out.
All right, so talk about the do's and don'ts then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, you know, what you want to make sure that you do is not, you know, think of it as stuff. I mean, this is something very important to the individual, and they do develop an attachment to it. You know, so you want to make sure that you're treating the individual with respect.
You're so not, the language you're using is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Don't say, get rid of this junk.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
If someone says their collections or their possessions, you would want to match their language. You would not want to be judgmental. This happens. You know, people walk in, what a mess.
Right.
You know, what's going on here? Eye rolling. People with hoarding are really, you know, they're very intuitive. They're watching people. You know, people might walk in and roll their eyes or have a look of disgust on their face. You'd really want to make sure you didn't do that. Mm-hmm. You really don't want to be making suggestions about what people should be doing with their stuff. Why don't you just get rid of it? Or why don't you just put all that over there? That doesn't help.
You definitely don't want to touch their possessions without their permission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're helping them at all, you know, ask permission before you touch anything or move anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading another article in preparation for this program, and I thought it was interesting that this caseworker was visiting a woman who was hoarding. And again, you know, things piled up over the windows. And she, I love her approach. She said, "I'm so worried about you because if they need to come in to rescue you, how will they save you?" How and so she, I guess, started the process then to get rid of some of these things. And then there's a little later in the story, she sees her on the street a little while later, a success story, you know, and hugs her and says, you know, she basically saved her. So there are cases, many cases where this works out okay in the end, right?
It does. I mean, I think a lot of times people are very socially isolated. You know, they're not having people in. It's hard for them to leave. And if a concerned person comes and offers support, or talks to them about the problem in a way that doesn't put them on the defensive, they just might be ready. You know, they might, that might loosen things up a little bit and get people to actually make some changes.
And then for the folks who, as you say, don't think there's a problem, what's the big deal? And, you know, it's my stuff, I can do what I want. Unless they really want the help, they're probably not going to get it, right?
That's, for the most part, that is true. And like Denise said earlier, that's, you know, sometimes when, you know, the authorities get brought in because, again, the neighbor complains or somebody's concerned, and where we don't want to have to enforce things when, you know, yes, there's no problem, you know, the person seems just happy enough, but maybe it truly is affecting their lives. They're not getting the nutrition that they need. They're not getting the exercise they need. And there's that possibility that the tall stacks of whatever material might fall over and crush them. So there is a safety issue there.
Yeah, motivation cannot be forced. We can't force people to do it, but there may be leverage. If someone's living in affordable housing, there's regular inspections. We can use those inspections as a way to organize people. There's a goal to work towards, and there's leverage to use. If the you know, if the Board of Health gets involved, if first responders get involved, we can do the good cop, bad cop kind of thing. But ultimately, people are in charge of living their lives the way they want to live their lives. And if they're in a private home, it can be much more difficult and take a lot longer. If they're in subsidized housing, when we have leverage and we can use leverage in a very organized time frame way, we can tend to get people moving.
And it's, I'm assuming this is like other mental health disorders, as it can happen to anybody. There isn't like a it's not more men than women or vice versa, or is it? I mean, who are generally the hoarders?
It tends to occur earlier in women, and women seek out treatment more than men, but it does occur in more men than women.
Interesting.
But it is, there are, you know, case examples from all across the world, years and years back. I mean, it's been around for a long time and it's everywhere.
I talked about Buried and Treasures Self-Help Group.
Yes.
That's a great name.
Yeah. So we've actually gotten a couple of grants. We got one grant through Cape Cod Healthcare's Community Benefits Program. And with that money, we put on community events. And one of the community events that we put on was a Buried and Treasures workshop, where a group of people came and talked about this group protocol and their experience with it. And what we wanted to do through the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force is develop local resources for people with this problem. So we committed to actually running this group. It is a very highly structured and active support group. It can be led by professionals or non-professionals. I'm leading one right now. It is a 15-session group that runs across 20 weeks, and we're basically following chapter by chapter the book that is called Buried in Treasures, Help for Compulsive Acquiring, Saving, and Hoarding, written by Dave Tolan, Gail Steckety, and Randy Frost. And this is a group that's running all across the world, actually. I have found it to be extremely helpful for my participants. We have about 11 people that come, and we're going to start collecting data. We're going to start a new group in May and start collecting quality of life and outcome data just to see how effective it is.
And I know you also, the task force is also interested in educating the rest of the public about what this is all about. And you've had some hoarders speak, or at least one who people were shocked, you know, when they found out that he was a hoarder. You know what I'm talking about? I can't remember his name right
Lee
now.
Lee Shore, yes, I believe. Yes, yeah. He was the one that spoke to us at the Buried and Treasures workshop. And he actually is the peer coordinator for the Buried and Treasures workshop in Western Mass.
In Western Mass.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, he was, you know, a wonderful speaker and a terrific person. But yeah, he was risking losing his relationship with his girlfriend, I believe. And that's what motivated him to change. Mm. And then, you know, we have had other events. Actually, the first event that we had at the Mid-Cape Hoarding Task Force was at Cape Cod Community College, and we showed a viewing of My Mother's Garden, which is a documentary about a woman in California, and her daughter made this documentary and found that her mother was living in a home where she actually had to crawl out the window because she couldn't get to the door, and she was actually sleeping outside because there wasn't enough room in the house. And what her family ended up doing was, again, what we don't promote, but they ended up doing a clean out. She took her mom to New York to her apartment. Her brothers cleaned out the house. And you were talking about it recurring. Her mother actually started hoarding while she was living at the daughter's apartment in New York and started building up. But, you know, we had a really good turnout there, and that was one of the first ones. And since then, we've done some trainings on two trainings on legal issues. And then we've also run we had an indoor air quality presentation actually at one of our meetings. Because if you think about it, some of the issues that you might run into, especially in squalor conditions, is, you know, breathing in bacteria and toxins. And we actually did have an individual who went into a hoarded home and ended up getting sick from it.
Mm-hmm. So we try to have one community event per year and one training for professionals per year. And some of that is funded through grants, and others is just volunteer time from people.
Right. So let's talk about the difference between squalor and hoarding then.
In squalor conditions, there tends to be hoarded food, rotting food, rodents, insects. And many times in a situation like that, there is hoarding that is occurring. But not every hoarding case has squalid conditions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because many times they say, oh, that person's got hoarding or hoarding disorder. They think, oh, it's dirty and there's, you know, there's rodents and insects and rotting food. And that's often not the case.
No, many, with the paper hoarders, it's just paper.
Many times people have a lot of clutter. They have an accumulation of possessions, but things are neat.
They have clean. A method to their filing. They could tell you where that newspaper was that you want to see that article in.
Yeah, many times, even if it looked very disorganized to us, they have a general sense of where things are. So we think that's an important distinction to make.
Erica, you mentioned training on legal issues. What would that be?
Basically, when you're responding to hoarding situations, obviously, when we go in, we issue an order. And oftentimes, it does go further than just that order because it doesn't get taken care of. Sometimes this has to go to the courts. But again, we're all kind of finding our way around this issue because it is just coming out. And then there's issues with making sure that you're making reasonable accommodations, especially now that it is an actual disorder, making sure that you know, the individual is getting what they need. And again, especially when you're talking about the affordable housing situations, you can't just kick somebody out.
And since you mentioned the affordable housing situation, there's a conference coming up, Using Team Approach to Address Hoarding and Affordable Housing, April 2nd, Marlboro.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is put on by Mass Housing and the Massachusetts State Steering Committee for Hoarding. And from what I understand, there's quite a large response to it, close to 400 individuals. And it's going to be a lot of housing authority people, but definitely health agents, fire departments. Mm-hmm.
Because what's happened is, so we've done a great job at educating people about what hoarding is, how to recognize it, how to treat people with hoarding disorder, why it occurs, what's going on. But we still have to figure out a better way of dealing with it, of helping people stay in their houses, resolve these issues. And so Mass Housing has, you know, they have a good model, and we're working to replicate that here on the Cape.
Denise Egan-Stack, a licensed mental health counselor, president of the board of directors for the International Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation, and Erica Woods, registered sanitarian assistant health agent for the town of Orleans, both steering committee members of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. We'll put a link up on our website to yours for people who want more information. Thanks so much for being here.
Great.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, preschool at Heritage Museum and Gardens with a STEM-based curriculum. Heritage Museum and Gardens in Sandwich is known for its acres of gardens, a working vintage carousel, and ongoing exhibits celebrating American culture. In September, they will open a year-round preschool with a focus on STEM-based curriculum. Joining us to talk about the 100-acre school at Heritage Museums and Gardens is Ellen Speer, President and CEO. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Melissa Russell, Preschool Director of the 100-acre school at Heritage. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So a large component of the Heritage mission is education. You already have a number of educational programs for children. It's not every day that you hear of a museum incorporating a school into the programming. So where did this idea come from?
Well, as we have put together our master plan, our board has decided that we really want to be a 21st century learning center. And we began to talk with the superintendent of Sandwich Schools, as you may have heard. There, their 7th and 8th graders are all going to go through an initiative which is a STEM academy. And we talked about what resources Heritage had and how we could help those kids succeed, because it's a very different way that kids in Sandwich will be educated. And we came to the conclusion that preparation for kindergarten and success in school leading up to that STEM academy was really in our wheelhouse. We have a lot of experience with little ones through 9-year-olds. Hidden Hollow has been a tremendous success. And we've developed a lot of STEM curriculum there. So if we pulled all that together, what could we do with it? So we surveyed 10,000 parents in the southeastern region that have kids of that age and asked them about their preschool experiences and found there really was a need for this kind of school to be created.
So the acronym STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. So do kids need to start STEM as early as preschool?
Well, first of all, we call it STEAM because we're not getting rid of history. We're not getting rid of art. But Melissa's really the expert in how preschool and STEM works.
Well, what we're excited about with STEM related to preschoolers is that at the preschool age level, kids are just naturally curious about the world around them. So it's not complicated to engage them in science or engage them in technology, engineering, or math. They're just already excited about learning those topics.
Yeah. So many, many educators maintain self-directed play key to this age group. So what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. We are still, you know, engaging that idea of play as the best part for learning for preschoolers. However, if we are guiding that play and infusing that play with exciting activities related to STEM, that we are allowing kids to develop some really great skills related to inquiry, related to asking questions about the world, related to having them develop hypotheses about what they see around them. And so we're just really enhancing that play curriculum and the idea of development in the preschool age.
What fun for you. That is such a great age. And the kids say that, I mean, they're so curious and they have such great insight. It's a fun group to be working with.
Well, we're really excited about that. And I think that Ellen has already mentioned, you know, we've had such huge success in Hidden Hollow. We have so many families that come with children between the ages of 2 and 10 and even younger that just love engaging in activities that not only are fun to play with, but really expand their mind. Mm-hmm. And kids are just really curious. And if you engage them in that curiosity, the things that they can do are just wonderful.
And really beyond that, too, it's developing what nationally have come to be known as 21st century learning skills, which are very different. Collaboration. You see kids on the playground of that age, they always get together to do things. So how do you develop and encourage that habit of mind? Having a global view. Kids are going to need to compete in a global world. It's not just the neighborhood. So getting that concept early is going to be very important. So those are the kinds of underlying skills. It's not just repeating math facts. That's really not what it's about. It's learning how to learn and developing that habit of mind, that inquiry habit of mind.
So some CAPE schools with STEM-based curriculum have decided to add the A, changing it to STEAM. You've got STEAM. So you are intending to include arts in the curriculum as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. The other advantage of this school is that in the core curriculum now, teachers are encouraged to use primary source material. museums have the stuff. That mm-hmm. is the primary source. So kids will be interacting with museum objects, with museum art, with museum historical objects, which is a different approach perhaps than in the past, but very much in keeping with where the Common Core curriculum is going.
So the 100-acre School of Heritage is a collaboration, as you mentioned, with the Sandwich Public Schools and the Sandwich Public Library. So tell us more about that collaboration.
The curriculum developers at the Sandwich Schools are going to be working with our curriculum developers and Melissa to actually put the lessons and what happens every day together. But the library has another really interesting component. We brought them in early as a partner because parents are the best and the first teachers. And what happens on the time that they're not in preschool is just as important. Mm-hmm. So the library already has some really wonderful science programs and engineering programs developed. So we're making sure that the library will coordinate their curriculum and presentations with what's going on in the school so parents can bolster and reinforce what's happened when they go to the library on the weekends or after school.
Yeah. So is the preschool open to any student from any district, or is this just Sandwich?
Yes, it is. It's open to anyone that would like to attend. It's not limited by town.
So what's the age range then for students, and how many do you expect to enroll? How much space do you have?
Excellent. We are, the age range is age 4 and 5. We are looking for students that will be age 4 as of September 1st. And we chose that because we would like to have a group of students that would be going on to kindergarten together. So we're looking for that pre-kindergarten year for students to stay together. Mm-hmm. And we are hoping to have 20 students in each of our two classrooms, so a total of 40 students.
And there's a cost involved in this, I would imagine, right? So will this, are there scholarships, financial aid? I would imagine some parents might have difficulty with paying for something like that.
At this point, the way that this will work is that we have full days or half days, 5 days a week, and on our website, 100acreschool.org, you can get the particulars of price. We'd love to set up a scholarship program in the future. Right now, however, we will be able to work with parents who have state subsidies, vouchers on the voucher program, mm-hmm. and we do have slots reserved for those students. So parents can contact us if they meet the income guidelines for the voucher program. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine this is a great thing to be looking at, the data that you can collect as you watch these kids go from the preschool into the kindergarten and going forward.
Yeah, there is a research component with this and an evaluation component as well, because we hope that the curriculum that Melissa and her colleagues create will be a model curriculum for the state potentially. We have received a grant from the State Department of Early Education and Care. They had an open grant round for organizations who wanted to create potential model curriculums in STEM.
So are there other museums doing this? I mean, are you the first? Do you know of anybody else that's doing something like this?
There are other museums that have preschools, but mostly it's Miss So-and-so's preschool that rents space
right.
at a museum. We believe it's the first time that a curriculum has been developed with a school system and a museum using museum objects mm-hmm. as part of the curriculum that will be embedded, if you will, in a preschool.
Yeah. So where are you at with the curriculum?
We are at our beginning phases of the exact curriculum that we're going to be offering for the fall. However, we have a vast resource of curriculum that we have developed for Hidden Hollow, and so we are excited to get started.
So you're going to incorporate some of the Hidden Hollow curriculum then with this?
Absolutely. We know we've had a lot of education components down there that have been very successful, and so we're looking to build on those.
Mm-hmm. So I would imagine as you get the 40 kids or so that you're looking for, there may be others that we have some sort of a waiting list. Is that what you're anticipating?
That would be a wonderful thing for us to have a waiting list.
Yeah. Great. And so I imagine, too, as this goes forward, you'll set the curriculum for this year and then see if you want to tweak it or make any changes as you go forward.
Absolutely. I think that's the most fun about being an educator, that your brain is never set in one particular path, that you're always reflecting and honing those components of pieces of lessons. And so we're excited about having a very fluid curriculum that will be reflective of the students in our classes and the season we might be having, different activities that may be going on throughout the museum.
Okay. Melissa Russell, Preschool Director of the 100 Acre School at Heritage, and Ellen Spear, President and CEO at Heritage. Thanks for coming in and telling us about the program.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point. with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.